The following is intended only for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Anthology of Horror podcast. I'm your host, Springheel Jack, and I'd like to preface today's episode with a brief disclaimer. I am in a foul fucking mood, and today's episode might be a little dark and a little cynical, which I know a lot of you guys like, but I wanted to give you a heads up ahead of time. Another brief disclaimer, earlier today before recording, I also had massive technical difficulties. All of my recording presets were deleted, so I'm kind of winging it as I go. So if the levels are off, or I sound a little bit different, that's why. Anyway, today's topic of conversation was the winner of an Instagram poll. For those of you that don't follow me on Instagram, every so often when I'm at a creative impasse, I post a poll on Instagram, and I let you guys, the listeners, decide what the next episode will be. Oftentimes I post choices that I don't think will win and I have no real desire to cover. Today, and this episode, is one of those choices. For whatever reason, you people selected Haunted Universal Studios as the number one choice, closely followed by listening to Eerie Bob speak Spanish for 2 hours while I ask him every 5 minutes, "What?" Thankfully, that one didn't win. But I am nothing, if not a man of my word, so I've put together a pretty decent episode for you today, all about the history of Universal Studios and the alleged hauntings that are said to happen there. So, disclaimers aside, let's get started. Actually, if you want to participate in polls in the future, be sure to follow me on Instagram at DukeLandis17. Now let's get started. Hollywood has always been known as a land where dreams come true. It's also known as a place where nightmares lurk in the shadows cast by the studio lights. Many aspiring actors and actresses come to Hollywood from whatever small town shithole they're from, seeking both fame and fortune. Most, they only find heartache and disappointment. For those strong enough to come to grips with their dreams of stardom being smashed to death on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, they limp home to a common life of work, indecision, and crippling debt, and eventually, death. For those not strong enough, life becomes one big regret from which they can never recover. Some turn to a life of drugs or alcohol in an attempt to forget their failures. Some start podcasts, while others seek a permanent solution to their despair. One such person has become the stuff of legend, not for the way she lived her life, but rather, the way that she ended it. Peg Entwistle was an up-and-coming actress from Great Britain who was beginning to shine on Broadway. Like so many others in the early days of Hollywood, Peg thought that she could make it big in Tinseltown. Once she moved out to California, she struggled to get roles until she was finally cast in her first big Hollywood production. Unfortunately for her, though, her scene was cut from the David O. Selznick film 13 Women, and that was the final straw for the distraught Entwistle. On September 16th, drunk and grief-stricken, Peg Entwistle climbed up to the top of the H of the Hollywood Land sign and jumped the 45 feet to her death. Peg has been haunting the sign ever since. Unfortunately, Peg Entwistle is not the only spirit that has become famous over time in this city of bullshit. On the contrary, Hollywood is considered by many charlatans and bullshit artists to be the most haunted city in the United States. It is a well-accepted theory in the research into paranormal activity that strong emotions at the time of death can be a catalyst for spirits to remain behind. Love and hate are two of the strongest emotions that a human being can feel, and these emotions are probably the two most common found in Hollywood, closely followed by a third, which is, of course, existential dread. Look at all the stories that have come out of this town. Love affairs abound, marriages broken up almost daily due to infidelity. And many of these lead to deeds too horrible to mention, although I'll mention them later because I don't give a shit. Some of these unmentionables have taken place at the various studios dotting the landscape. Then there are those whose love of their craft is so deep that they can't let it go even in death. These individuals care so deeply for not only their artistry, but also the studios themselves that their spirits remain behind to watch over a place that they loved in their life. With all the sad and sometimes horrendous deaths that have taken place in Hollywood, can one really fail to see why it is sometimes called the most haunted city? Universal Studios is one of the oldest studios in Hollywood, and it is indeed the largest studio ever built. After all, it is called Universal City. With the vast amount of public access that has been granted even before the studio became a themed entertainment park, is it any wonder that it would also be one of the most haunted studios in Hollywood? Ha, nay, I think not. Many tales abound in the studio's various lots, some stemming from the very beginning, others as new as day. For those expecting gruesome and horrific tales, be warned, most of the spirits at Universal are more helpful than horrible. Some are secretive and private, others just want to be remembered, and others go about their craft as if they are still in the prime of their life. One thing is for certain, though. Universal Studios is most assuredly one of the most haunted locations in all of Hollywood land. Today, Universal Studios is mainly known as an amusement park, a place to go for thrills and chills and where fans can see their favorite TV and movie characters come to life or visit Hogwarts and the world of Harry Potter. Even while guests are relaxing on the backlot tram tour and casting their gazes on movie sets from Hollywood's historic past, they still seem almost oblivious to the fact that Universal is a working, functional movie studio. Universal put the horror movie genre on the map and stopped one of America's greatest inventors from holding a monopoly on film production that would have changed the way we all view movies today. Universal Studios' history cannot be fully understood without knowing who had the dream to make Hollywood what it is today, and who it was that had the strength and the determination to fight and win against a corporate giant to make Tinseltown the glamour capital of the world. So, here's a bit of history for you guys. Carl Laemmle was born in 1867 in the Jewish area near Lopheim, Germany. His father was a cattle merchant and a part-time land trader, but the family still struggled financially. Carl and his siblings grew up in poverty. He was one of the youngest of 11 children. However, only three other siblings survived into adulthood, the others having passed due to sickness or epidemic. By the age of 13, Carl had gotten a job as an apprentice and was supporting his family while continuing his education. During his time as an apprentice, Laemmle learned the art of salesmanship and accounting, lessons that he would put to use very well later in life. By the time that Carl was 17 years old, he was ready to leave his old life behind. After his mother passed away, and after reading all of the letters his brother Joseph had been sending from America, Carl decided to join him in the United States. Carl's father gave him his blessing, $50, and two tickets on a ship. One for Carl, and one for Carl's longtime friend, Leo Hirschfeld. Carl had failed to inform his brother that he would be arriving in New York, and of course there was no one to meet him at the docks. So the two men were taken to a boarding house by one of the relatives of travel companions they had met on their voyage from Europe. After about 2 weeks of doing odd jobs around New York City, Carl began looking for his brother and found him working in Chicago, Illinois as a secretary to the vice president of a German language newspaper. Joseph sent his brother $10 and a bus ticket to Chicago. And just like that, Carl was on his way to the Windy City. Once in Chicago, Carl made a meager living doing odd jobs all over the city. He even tried his hand at farming in South Dakota for a short time, but found that he had no desire or talent for that type of work. Carl did say, however, that his time at the farm taught him the value of a dollar more than any other job he had ever had. He also said that it was the hardest job he had ever worked in his life. After only 7 weeks of life on the farm, Carl Lemley found himself back in Chicago, working low-paying, dead-end jobs and depending on his brother's charity to get by in life. Even though his life in America was not turning out the way that Carl had planned it, after several trips back to his hometown in Germany, Lemley knew that life in the United States was what his destiny demanded. So he applied for United States citizenship and took the oath of loyalty in 1889, and America officially became his home. In 1894, Lemley moved to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, to begin working as a bookkeeper of the Continental Clothing Company. It had been 10 years since Lemley had arrived in America, and Carl had finally found a job that not only paid well, but allowed him to pursue creative avenues as well. Lemley had always been intrigued by showmanship and now decided to learn the ins and outs of publicity and the ways in which flamboyance played a key part. Lemley began creating and distributing catalogs that were artistic and catered to customers. He began to upgrade the mediocre advertising of the company with bold, creative ad campaigns and designed window displays. Through it all, he asked for customer feedback to keep up with the trends to keep the company competitive and up to date. All of Carl's hard work paid off when Sam Stern promoted him to a management position. Carl was now set in his career at the clothing company. In 1898, Carl married Sam Stern's niece, Recha Stern, and together they had two children, Rosabelle and Julius. He was voted one of the 15 most eminent and enterprising businessmen in Oshkosh in 1905. And what rigid competition that must have been. Lemley had a beautiful family and a career that put him in the high upper class of society, yet he was not content. In 1906, Carl Lemley decided to go into business for himself. He had amassed savings of just over $3,000, which, in case you guys want to hate yourself, that's roughly $75,000 today, and he planned on investing that money in a chain of retail stores catering to low and middle income customers. While scouting the city of Chicago for a good location to open up his first store, he noticed a long line of people standing outside one of the new Nickelodeons. I'm talking about the old style of entertainment, not the palace of pedophilia that it became in later years, or the palace of pedophilia that shares the same name. Intrigued by the growing crowd, Lemley waited in line, and once inside became enthralled by what he saw and the way that people reacted to the moving pictures. Lemley knew that this was the wave of the future, that people would flock to the picture shows and hand over their hard-earned money to get away from the daily rigors and worries of life. He decided right then and there that this was what he would put his life savings into, and this was the business that he would invest his future in. Lemley observed the Nickelodeon he had found along with others in the city and was amazed at the constant flow of people handing over 10 cents to enter the storefront theater. Most business people believed that the moving pictures were simply a trend, a flash in the pan, amusement that would die out in short time and then be gone. After all, how many people would actually stay amused by sitting in a dark theater watching pictures flit across a small screen while music played in time to the scene? Most thought moving pictures had about 5 years before the stage regained its prominence and the movie houses went away the same way the dodo bird had. After watching the crowds endlessly handing over their money, Carl Lemley was one of the few who knew that motion pictures were here to stay. So Lemley took his savings and opened his first Nickelodeon, called the White Front Theater, on Chicago's Milwaukee Avenue. This first theater was so successful that it didn't take long before Carl was able to open a second venue called the Family Theater, which also did extremely well. By all accounts, Lemley was on his way to a prosperous business venture. Carl, however, saw another way to expand his fortune. One of the things that Lemley noticed with his theaters was the hassle in renting the films that he was showing. The Nickelodeons had a high-volume turnaround of films, needing to change daily, sometimes twice a day, so it became frustrating having to deal with the various studios' distribution divisions, each trying to get its movies and shorts into the movie houses that would show them, and each making the theater owners buy the films at high prices but also making them wait on the reels to actually show up. Film exchanges solved the problem of having to buy the films, and many of the theater owners were just perfectly content with renting. But the exchanges were still slow to arrive at the venues, if they arrived at all, and many of the films would be withdrawn for payment issues before the owner could get them spooled up. Lemley became so frustrated with trying to get films for his theaters that he decided to start up his own exchange, run it his way, with higher efficiency than the exchanges he would compete with. Lemley knew the importance of being independent, and that other non-corporate theater owners felt the exact same way. So when Carl opened up his Lemley Film Service, he was determined to make it easier and cheaper for the independent theater owners to obtain the films that they needed to make a profit. Lemley became so successful with his exchange that by 1908, he had opened offices in Chicago and six other states from the West Coast to the Great Lakes. In just 2 years, Lemley had become the largest film distributor in America. Lemley was never one to shy away from notoriety, and he wanted his exchange to be known not only for its quality of service, but for its name recognition as well. One of the things that had always been important in Carl Lemley's life was for a man to live up to his word. So when Lemley told a customer that the film he was renting for his theater would arrive on a certain date and at a certain price, Lemley made sure that it would be in his customer's hand when it was supposed to be. Always keeping my word is something I admire about myself as well. One of maybe two things I admire about myself. So this dedication to customer service earned him the respect of everyone that he dealt with. There were those, however, who were watching what Carl was doing and who were not happy that he was taking business away from them. And so it goes in corporate America. Standing at just 5 feet, 3 inches tall, Carl Lemley was not what one would call an imposing figure. What he lacked in stature, he made up in pure determination and tenacity. It may have been Lemley's decided lack of height that caused one of the most respected inventors and scientists in the history of the United States and the world to mistake size for ability and brains, leading to one of Thomas Edison's worst defeats. Edison had invented the kinetoscope in 1888 and soon improved this early movie camera to the point where movies became a successful entertainment industry. Edison not only produced and sold his cameras through his company, known as the Edison Manufacturing Company, but he also began to produce motion pictures for mass audiences. By 1894, as a way to protect his fledgling motion picture business, Edison had gathered together a legal team to harass and bring lawsuits against other companies involved in motion picture production for infringement. Edison, using scare tactics and the threat of lawsuits, managed to put many of his competitors out of business or forced them to pay monthly licensing fees for the use of the cameras that they had already purchased from him, which is a great fucking hustle, but a chicken shit business practice. By 1909, Edison had coerced his main competitor, the Biograph Company, along with Eastman Kodak, which provided the film for his movie cameras, to join into a conglomerate. Together they formed the Motion Picture Patents Company, also known as the Edison Trust. So now combined with the most powerful and influential film companies, Edison was able to establish a monopoly on cameras, projectors, and film. And that allowed his trust to impose a monthly $2 tax on all film production companies and on all producers. And also on exchange owners who used any of his, Kodak's, or Biograph's inventions, which was pretty much everybody at the time. Lemley, at the helm of the largest exchange company in the country, was naturally pretty miffed at the added cost of doing business, and he considered Edison's tax not only illegal, but a monopoly as well. So Lemley decided to fight back, and Edison responded with over 300 separate lawsuits spread out over the lifetime of the battle between the two stubborn men. Carl Lemley was an intelligent man, and he realized from the very beginning that he would be unable to take on Edison and his trust alone. Lemley knew that there were many independent film producers and studios who were not at all happy with the situation they found themselves in, and he not only organized these independents into a cohesive unit, but he also became their de facto leader. Lemley accomplished this feat by becoming one of them, by forming his own production company, known as the Independent Moving Picture Company, or the IMP. After creating his new company and organizing the other independents to fight against Edison, Lemley tried his case in the highest court of the land, which is, of course, the Court of Public Opinion. As the public slowly came over to his side, he again employed a new and powerful weapon in the fight. Knowing that the public liked their idols, Lemley instituted something that had not only been forbidden in the field of movie making, but also feared. Lemley knew that it would be the final piece in the puzzle of defeating Edison and his stranglehold over the equipment needed to make movie making the business that he knew it could become. The new weapon would become known as the Star System. During the early days of the Nickelodeon and silent film era, the stars were treated as nothing more than simple commodities. The reason for this attitude had to do with the fear of actors becoming too big in the eyes of the movie-going public. Stars who were idolized and in demand would be able to demand more perks, more concessions, and worst of all, more pay. And this is why the actors and actresses of the early cinema were not known by their names, but by titles such as Babyface, Little Mary, or The Girl with the Curls. Edison and his cronies knew this, and they were appalled when they found out that Lemley had begun putting the stars' names out to the public and promoting and advertising them. Edison couldn't understand how Lemley could be so inept at business as to undermine his own profits in this way, but figured that in the long run, Lemley would do his job for him and would thereby, you know, eliminate himself. Lemley, for his part, knew that this idea would cost him money up front, but could, in the long run, garner him more profits from the star power that he was creating. Lemley began offering more money to trust actors than Edison was willing to pay, and placing actors under contract directly with his studio production company. In this way, Lemley managed to, quote, create the careers of notables like King Baggett and Mary Pickford. The advertising ploy worked to perfection, and IMP began to grow with its profits. In 1915, the Supreme Court ruled that the Edison Trust was in violation of the Sherman antitrust laws for, and I quote, hampering free compensation in the creation of a monopoly. And the Motion Pictures Parents Company, after having sued Carl Lemley 289 times, was thereby dissolved. Carl Lemley and the independents had won against a seemingly unstoppable, wealthy, and powerful group of America's premier business icons. But this victory was only the beginning for the man who was about to usher in the magic of movie making and bring dreams to life on the silver screen. Before the Edison Trust was ordered to dissolve, Carl Lemley and his group of investors and film producers created the Universal Film Manufacturing Company and moved all of their production facilities from Chicago to Fort Lee, New Jersey, of all places. Once the issues with Edison and his trust had been settled and all of his attention could be focused on making films, Lemley knew that if he was going to continue to grow his company, he would need to expand his operations. Lemley had invested some of his money into a ramshackle studio in Hollywood, California, at the corner of Gower and Sunset Boulevard. And by 1911, he had begun making films on the West Coast. His main studio was still, of course, in Fort Lee. But as production grew out in sunny Southern California, Lemley began to realize the inherent advantages of the almost perpetual sunshine on the cost of producing movies. This realization led Lemley to seek out a larger lot where he could expand his West Coast production facilities, and in so doing, expand his profits as well. In August of 1912, the Universal Film Manufacturing Company leased the Oak Crest Ranch in the San Fernando Valley, and they began transforming it into a bona fide film lot. Once the lease was in place, Lemley built a series of stages and outdoor movie sets. This included a Native American village, complete with Chamorro actors and actresses and 100 horses from the Isleta Reservation near Albuquerque, New Mexico. It also had enough housing to accommodate up to 65 families who would become permanent residents living on the studio grounds. The first grand opening of the movie ranch was held on December 10th, 1912, and the event was open to the public. Invitations were sent out to actors and actresses from the other studios, along with hand-delivered invites to state and local politicians as well as dignitaries. Lemley was not one to skimp when it came to promoting his interests, and he wanted the opening of his new studio to stand out. Carl Lemley was not content with having an ordinary movie studio. He figured that if he was going to make films the way that he wanted, he would need to have everything he needed already on hand for use. To this end, Lemley brought in horses, created workshops where carriages and other props could be built, stored, and so on and so forth. He even had a complete western town built along with other street facades permanently erected on his leased lot. Lemley once quipped that he had built his own city, and that simple statement gave him an idea. On July 10th, 1913, Universal Oak Crest Ranch had its second grand opening. This time, however, it was to celebrate the changing of its name to that of Universal City. Once again, politicians and the public were invited to marvel at what Lemley had built in the foothills near Hollywood. The big attraction at this gala event was the Universal City Zoo. The zoo was really nothing more than a small menagerie consisting of a few sheep, goats, horses, one pig, but the crowd seemed enthralled that the studio had its own animals on hand. The zoo itself would grow to house many different types of wildlife, including an elephant, a lion, and exotic birds from all around the world. The success of the two grand openings prompted Lemley to open his studio to the public on a daily basis. Lemley had many photographs taken of the sets and stages to promote renting them out to other studios and to individual producers. And he figured that with this rental money, along with the small 5-cent admission fee charged to the public to see how movies were made, his profits would grow. Part of the appeal for moving to Hollywood was the scenery provided by the Los Angeles River, the Santa Monica Mountains, and the nearby desert landscape. These same assets also helped to lure the public to Universal City. The crowds loved watching the gunfights in the western towns as cowboys battled the rampaging Native Americans or the local sheriff squared off in the dusty main street of the town, outdrawing the outlaw in a one-on-one duel for law and order. Universal was a complete success, and things could not have gone better for Universal Studios and its investors. Lemley, however, was still not content, which is going to be a common theme of his life. This guy, he was a real ambitious fucker. He saw the success as a sign that the studio needed to expand and grow. If it was to become the premier studio in Hollywood, it still needed more room. The idea of growing the company was not universally agreed upon by the partners, but eventually, Lemley gained sole ownership of Universal Film Manufacturing and immediately began looking for a new plot of land. What the company found was a large 230-acre plot along Lancashire Boulevard, which included the Nestor Ranch, the Taylor Ranch, and Bogue, Davis, and Hershey ranches. Lemley promptly bought the property for a whopping $165,000. Once the sale was complete, Universal began a wide, sweeping construction project in October of 1914 that included 600 sets, 90 stages, a bank, a post office, living quarters, a school for those children living on the studio grounds, a new, bigger zoo, and a police station. Lemley had actually attained his dreams of building his own city. The new Universal City was built directly across the street from where the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which ended the Mexican-American War, was signed. The Ogden City Standard described the site as, and I quote, "occupying a comparatively level plateau, forming the front of a basin something over a mile in diameter, entirely surrounded by mountains. From the center of the city, one obtains a view of a greater diversity of scenery than is possible in any other place in America." In other words, it was a perfect place to make movies. Formal groundbreaking took place in May of 1914, and the production of Damon and Pythias began in July of the same year. Lemley held his third grand opening on October 15, 1914. But this celebration was for employees of the studio and their families only. It was meant to show them how important Lemley thought they were, and how he thought of them as family. It was at this event that he announced the plans for a huge public opening planned for February 2, 1915. He told those gathered that it would be the grandest spectacle the state had ever seen and would be remembered for generations to come. As the construction of the new studio progressed, it became clear that it would not be completed in time for the February deadline, and the grand opening was pushed back until March 15th. Always the showman, Carl Lemley not only planned a spectacle for the opening of his new Universal City, but also created a way to prolong the event by planning a train trip from Chicago, Illinois, to Hollywood, with whistle stops in Denver, Albuquerque, the Grand Canyon, and other sites all along the way. He even came up with a name for himself and those he invited to ride along on the trip, and that was Universalites. All of the people that he invited gathered at the Sherman Hotel in downtown Chicago for a gala send-off before boarding the Universal train heading for Hollywood. The Universal train finally pulled into Los Angeles' Union Station on Monday morning, March 15, 1915. Guitars and ukuleles began to play, and as the Universalites stepped onto the platform, they were greeted by all manner of actor and actress in costumes depicting the guests' favorite movies and shorts. After 6 days of sightseeing and being cooped up on a train, when the travelers heard the music, they broke out into spontaneous dancing on the arrival platform. The Los Angeles Times reported it this way. At the Santa Fe station here, the entire population of Universal Indians, band, cowboys, and actors were gathered in welcoming enthusiasm and small-arm salvos, and a ukulele chorus accomplished a tantrum of noise that brought East First Street to the fore. So far as Lemley could tell, the day's festivities could not have started better. Once the spur-of-the-moment festivities were finally at an end, the Universalites boarded buses and headed the few remaining miles to the hills just north of Hollywood, where the gates of the new Universal City stood waiting before them. The group was dropped off on Lancashire Boulevard, and with Carl Lemley leading the way, they walked the short distance to where Universal City's mayor, police chief, and commissioners were gathered to greet them as an honor guard of sorts. Even though the governing board comprised elected members, since Universal City was never an actual incorporated municipality, all of the 28 elected positions were considered to be somewhat honorary. As California granted women the right to vote in 1911, of the 28 people elected to the administration of Universal, 10 positions went to suffragettes, including actress Grace Cunard, who was elected city assessor, and Laura Oakley, who was voted in as the police chief. On opening day, the estimated crowd was roughly 10,000 strong. Most of the guests arrived by bus, but an astonishing 500 cars were parked in the dirt lots just outside of the gate. This may not sound like a lot today, but in 1915, Los Angeles was not yet a city devoted to its car culture. Most people either used public transportation, horse-drawn buggies, or wagons. The number of automobiles that showed up for this two-day event is absolutely phenomenal. The crowd cheered as Carl Laemmle strode up to the gate, holding high the keys that would unlock the gate to the, and I quote, strangest city in the world, as it was dubbed by the press. With Chief of Police Laura Oakley, Mayor A.M. Kennedy, who was also the studio manager, and some of Universal's biggest stars by his side, Laemmle made a show of unlocking the gate and with a grand flourish, throwing it open wide. There was a controlled rush to get inside to see what Uncle Carl had created. As with every phase of the grand opening, everything was done specifically to amaze the public. There were barkers placed along Main Street directing people where to go. The guests were purposefully funneled past things that they were meant to see, such as the new outdoor stage, the unfinished studio commissary, which had a sign poking fun at Universal's own movie, The Great Universal Mystery, reading The Great Hash Mystery, which would be a great name for a weed shop, and past sets that were put up to give the crowd just a little bit of the taste of movie making. Laemmle also wanted the guests to know that what he had created was indeed his own city, so the crowd was paraded past the city's post office, the bank, the schoolhouse, and the zoo. He intentionally left out showing them the living area, but made sure that they were all well aware of it. They all caught fleeting glimpses of the Native American living area. This was done to get them ready for the Western show that they were going to see as soon as they arrived at the viewing stands. As soon as the crowd arrived at the viewing area, it was standing room only, they were greeted by the sight of a fully loaded stagecoach slowly making its way towards them. The stagecoach, still a fair distance away, was clearly visible to all. And as they watched, a loud noise and a cloud of dust arose from behind a small hill. The dust was caused by over a dozen horses ridden by the Universal Indians, and the noise was their war cry as they attacked the otherwise peaceful stagecoach. The driver urged the horses into a full gallop, but the attacking Indians were clearly gaining and now began to fire their rifles, trying to stop the settlers. The crowd gasped as the stagecoach reached the western town erected in front of the grandstands, and the townsfolk came out to see what was going on. The Indians, seeing the town alive, began to fire on the citizens, and many of them went down in a hail of gunfire. The men of the town drew their own pistols and rifles and fought back. The crowd cheered with each Indian that was hit. The settlers slowly gained the advantage, and the attacking Indians fled or surrendered. And then the show was over, and the guests clapped as loud as they could and again cheered for their heroes. They applauded as the Indians arose or rode back to town to take their bows, and there was not a face in the crowd not wearing a smile. Carl Laemmle wore the biggest grin of all, though, as he realized that the first day of his two-day grand opening was a tremendous success. The only mar on an otherwise perfect day came when pilot Frank Stites had to cancel his aerobatics and flying stunts when the wind became too strong for his biplane to take off. Laemmle, however, promised that Stites' exploits would go on the following day of the grand opening. So, on March 16, 1915, the second day of the grand opening, it started with a little less fanfare than the proper opening day celebration. But the crowds that showed up at the gates of Universal City hadn't diminished in the least. Thousands of spectators came to see what Carl had in store for them on this, the second day of the grand opening party. As you might imagine, Western films were the most popular in the early days of the cinema, and as luck would have it, the easiest to produce. Carl knew how important these films were, so he planned a whole day in which his guests could not only watch how they were filmed, but also get up close and personal with the cowboys themselves. Universal had hired about 30 cowboys to work in the various pictures that they were always filming, and he had most of them wandering around, entertaining the crowd with rope tricks, wrangling, and horsemanship. There was even a full-blown rodeo that the guests could watch. One of the things that many of the guests had noticed was the odd arrangement of the city itself. While sitting and watching the Wild West shows and rodeos, they could imagine themselves actually sitting in the Wild West of the past. And then, with a quick look to the right, they were staring at the back of Tudor-style buildings like those found in old-timey England. And with a glance to the left, they could be transported to Moscow and a Russian Orthodox church. Looking at this varied landscape with scenery from all over the world, one could fully understand why the press had dubbed Universal City the strangest city on Earth. The main event for the festivities of this day, and the reason that I'm kind of belaboring the whole grand opening story, I can hear you guys getting bored, but trust me, we're getting there. The main event for the festivities this day was Frank Stites finally doing his goddamn flying aerobatics. Having had to cancel his flight on opening day, Frank was anxious to show the crowd what he could do. Frank believed that for him to remain a competitive flyer, he would have to keep up with the Curtis Exhibition flying team. One of its members had tragically died just 2 days earlier while attempting a stunt in San Francisco when his plane's wing had broken away and he had fallen to his death in the San Francisco Bay. Frank knew that something like that could happen any time he took to the air, but like most young pilots, he figured that it would never happen to him. On this day, Frank was to perform a series of loops, plunges, and various other stunts, culminating in a mock attack on another aircraft. This other plane was actually on wires, strung between poles out of sight and rigged with explosives. Stites was supposed to attack the plane and, when directly overhead, drop a dummy bomb on the craft that would cause it to explode. Afterwards, Stites was to perform a victory barrel roll. Stites was given the signal from the ground to proceed with the mock bomb drop, and he made a perfect run on the mock plane. The replica airplane was set to explode when Stites' cloth and twine bomb got close. However, the explosion was stronger than expected, and the concussion caused Stites to lose control of his airplane. Stites and his craft were now in a free fall, with Frank trying everything his training told him to do, with no success. When Stites realized that it was a lost cause and his plane was going to crash, he attempted to jump to safety, but he was still 60 feet from the ground. When his body finally made impact with the ground, he was killed instantly. But fear not, this would not be the last time that anybody heard from Frank Stites. However, it would seem that even though his career as a stunt pilot was most assuredly over, as well as his life, he wasn't quite ready to retire. The tragic and deadly accident that second day of the festivities took most of the joy out of the rest of the celebration, and Carl Laemmle decided to end the event early, but not wanting to disappoint his guests and send them away with a sour taste over the death, Laemmle, ahead of schedule, loaded his Universalites onto a train and sent them to the end of their epic journey at the San Francisco Panama Pacific Exhibition. And even with the accident, both Laemmle and the public considered the grand opening of the world's first and largest only self-dedicated, self-contained movie studio a complete and total success. So it seems like I overprepared on the early history of Universal, and to make up for the 45 minutes of just monotonous droning about Carl Laemmle's early life, I'm now going to do a brief sum up of the years following the grand opening until damn near the modern era. While Carl Laemmle was establishing his city of make-believe at Universal Studios, the First World War was intensifying in Europe. The conflict engulfed Europe and parts of the Middle East. The United States maintained neutrality, yet it largely sympathized with France against Germany. Laemmle, who, as you might remember, was originally from Germany, but fiercely loyal to his adopted American home, found himself in a precarious position as his ties to Germany, including employing German directors and promoting German actors, sparked suspicion among the American public. In response to rising anti-German sentiment and to reshape his and Universal Pictures' image, Lemley got involved in producing anti-war propaganda depicting Germans negatively, such as the sinking of the Lusitania and the Kaiser, the Beast of Berlin, which is a badass name for a movie. These films successfully altered the public's perception, aligning Lemley and Universal with American sentiments. However, this stance caused Lemley to become persona non grata in his German hometown post-war. Despite his efforts to aid Germany's reconstruction and promote goodwill through Universal Pictures. Through the years, though, Universal Studios thrived under Lemley's leadership, inviting the public to witness filmmaking firsthand and producing hits like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Phantom of the Opera. These successes, however, were shadowed by challenges, including the transition from silent to sound films and the financial strains leading to Carl Lemley's inevitable selling of Universal. Despite these hardships, Lemley remained committed to aiding Jewish families during the rise of Hitler, which was in stark contrast to other Hollywood executives' apolitical stances. Carl died at the age of 72, a titan of the movie industry. After the death of Carl Lemley, the studio passed to his son, Carl Lemley Jr., who made a string of bad financial decisions and only had control of the company for a brief time. And it was the end of an era, essentially, when he couldn't repay a loan, so he sold Universal to Standard Capital. And Standard Capital quickly shut down all of their European operations and the public studio tours. They deemed them too noisy for talking movies and a general liability. However, under their leadership, films like My Man Godfrey and Three Smart Girls helped to save Universal from complete and total bankruptcy. Despite early challenges, Universal found success with films like Showboat and any Dina Durbin movie, really, which all made a significant profit. World War II shifted public demand to escapism, met by Universal with comedies, war musicals, and monster movies. The introduction of Technicolor brought hits like Arabian Nights and the Phantom of the Opera remake. After the war, the studio adapted to audience demands for quality entertainment. They merged with International Pictures and shifted its production focus under the new leadership, which included cutting low-budget productions and horror films. Universal once again expanded back into the European market, adjusted its film lineup, and faced financial fluctuations, navigating the changing landscape of moviegoing and the rise of television. By leasing films to TV and selling the studio lot to MCA, Universal adapted to industry changes as well. The 1950s to the 1970s saw innovations in film contracts and a mix of blockbusters and TV production. The studio continued to evolve through mergers and acquisitions, including all sorts of different companies, until it eventually became part, and is still part, of NBC Universal under Comcast. So it's impossible to think of Universal without thinking of classic monsters. And there's a reason for that, because they created the iconic images of Frankenstein's monster, the mummy, Count Dracula, as far as he's depicted in movies, the Wolfman, and the creature from the Black Lagoon. These creatures, while not originally Universal's creations, were immortalized through their films, and they left a lasting impact on pop culture and Halloween costumes across the world. The studio's foray into horror began in 1913 with films like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and The Werewolf, which set the stage for future successes. Universal's big hits came with The Hunchback of Notre Dame in 23, Phantom of the Opera in 25. Films celebrated for their groundbreaking makeup artistry, particularly by Lon Chaney, known as the Man of a Thousand Faces. His transformative techniques brought a new level of realism and terror to the screen. With the arrival of talkies, That saw Universal solidifying its horror legacy with Dracula in 1931, which introduced Bela Lugosi's captivating Count. Frankenstein also came out in 1931, and that was a pretty innovative piece of film because Boris Karloff's portrayal of the monster added depth and sympathy to the character. These films, alongside others like The Mummy and The Invisible Man, not only thrilled audiences, but also evoked empathy for the monsters, which seems to be a recurring theme in Universal's horror films. The studio continued to innovate with films based on Edgar Allan Poe's works, and they introduced the Wolfman again in 1941, creating another enduring legend. However, by the late 1940s, the original monster era waned, symbolically ending with Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in 1948, and that was where horror met comedy. After World War II, Universal adapted to changing tastes, exploring science fiction horror, reflecting nuclear age fears, notably with It Came from Outer Space and The Creature from the Black Lagoon. These films maintained Universal's tradition of blending fear with empathy towards the misunderstood creatures. Universal's impact extends to the modern era of horror with Psycho, which came out in 1960, pioneering the slasher genre, and The Birds in 1963, thrilling audiences with suspense. Currently, Universal plans to revive and unite its classic monsters in a shared universe, introducing these iconic characters to a new generation. So to sum up, Universal Studios not only crafted the definitive image of horror's most beloved monsters, but also influenced the way that horror is depicted in cinema, making an indelible mark on both the genre and on pop culture. So my absolute favorite aspect of Universal is by far the Backlot Tour. I have season passes to Universal pretty much only for this reason. The tram tour originated in 1964 as Universal Studios sought to capitalize on the growing public interest in the movie-making process. Initially, it offered a simple insight into the studio's operations, but over the years it has evolved into an incredibly sophisticated attraction featuring high-tech simulations, special effects, and dedicated set pieces designed specifically to dazzle the guests. Visitors get to see actual sets and sound stages where famous movies and TV shows were filmed. Iconic sets like those from Psycho, War of the Worlds, and Jaws offer a tangible connection to cinematic history. The tour provides insights into the complexities of filmmaking, including set construction, special effects, and the use of green screens. Guests learn about the history of Universal Studios and its impact on the film industry, making it an educational experience as well as an entertaining one. Universal Studios continually updates the Backlot Tram Tour, adding new attractions and updating existing ones to reflect new movies and advancements in technology. This ensures that the tour remains fresh and relevant, offering repeat visitors something new to discover. The Universal Backlot has not operated, though, for over 100 years without incident. The Backlot has experienced several fires over the years, with the most notable ones occurring in 1990, 1997, and 2008. These fires have caused significant damage to the sets, the archives, and the attractions, impacting both the studio's operations and, unfortunately, its historical legacy. The fire in November of 1990 caused extensive damage to the backlot, destroying several sets used for filming and attractions that were part of the Universal Tour. This included the New York street set, which was a fixture used in countless films and television shows to represent urban environments. The fire reportedly started due to a security guard's negligence, leading to a significant loss estimated at around $25 million. In 1997, another fire broke out, further damaging the backlot and its facilities. While this one is not as widely reported as the other two fires, any damage to the studio is a setback, affecting production and altering the historical landscape of the Universal Studios backlot. The fire on June 1st, 2008 was one of the most devastating incidents in the history of Universal Studios. It destroyed a large part of the backlot, including once again New York Street. It decimated the King Kong attraction and a vast array of film and television sets. Additionally, the fire consumed a warehouse that housed 40,000 to 50,000 video and digital copies of Universal's film and television library, along with a significant portion of the studio's music archive, including, unfortunately, original recordings belonging to Universal Music Group. The cause of the 2008 fire was initially attributed to workers using blowtorches to repair the roof of a building on the New York street set. Sparks from the blowtorches reportedly ignited nearby materials, and the fire quickly spread due to strong winds. The aftermath saw Universal Studios rebuilding and updating the damaged areas, including the introduction of an enhanced New York Street and a brand new King Kong 360 3D attraction, designed by Peter Jackson to replace the destroyed King Kong encounter. These fires underscore the challenges and risks that are associated with maintaining large-scale production facilities and archives. They also highlight the importance of safety protocols and preservation efforts in protecting the invaluable culture and historical assets housed within the Universal backlot. The studio's response to these incidents, through rebuilding and innovation, reflects its resilience and its commitment to preserving Hollywood's cinematic legacy. And I remember when I was a kid, it was widely speculated that these fires, every single one of them, was arson. Because, to quote some guy in some movie that I don't remember, all good things must one day be burned down to collect the insurance money. And finally, the moment you've all been waiting for. Let's talk about some ghosts and alleged hauntings. So if you guys remember from earlier in the episode, Frank Stites was an airplane stuntman who was killed on the second day of the grand opening in 1915. His performance went just about every way but as planned. And when Frank Stites' body hit the ground after he jumped from his stricken airplane, he was found, and I quote, that his spinal column was driven into his skull. And at the time, he was posed to become the world's greatest aviator, dead at the young age of 32. Frank was all but forgotten over time, just another weird footnote in the history of the famed studio. No one seemed to care or even think about him within the movie industry or even at Universal. That is, until the summer of 2015. That year, the creative director for the ever-popular Halloween Horror Nights was given the job of bringing the attraction back to the studio after it had been on hold for the last 5 years. One of the things that the creative director wanted to start up was a new nighttime backlot tour to be offered with a paid Halloween event ticket. This Terror Tram, as it was going to be called, would travel around the established tour route, but with monstrous interruptions. One night, while he and his assistant were roaming around the area near the Psycho House, he heard the sound of giggling. The director knew that he and his assistant were the only ones in that section of the backlot, and even though the giggle only lasted a moment, the, quote, diabolical tenor of the sound frightened him to the point of fleeing. His assistant had to convince the director to come back, which took a while. But then, just as he returned, The giggling sounded again, but this time much closer. Both he and his assistant fled from the area, and neither returned that evening. The following day, the news of the director and his aide had already made its way around the staff room before he had even made it to work. Needless to say, most of the staff found it quite amusing that a man who had a deep love for all things horror and who had been a haunter for most of his life had been so easily frightened by a ghost. There were those that just assumed that the two had come across a security guard who had either inadvertently scared the two Horror Night staff members or had, you know, gotten a wild hair up his ass and decided to play a little joke on him. Whichever was the case, it made it even more amusing for those who didn't believe in spirits. There were others, however, who decided that since their boss had an experience, that they would open up about strange events that had happened to them on the backlot as well. Many of the things the director was being told were markedly different from what had happened to him the night before. There was one story repeated by several different staff members, and though some of the details were different, the story and the sightings were all the same. Quite a few people told him they saw a figure wearing a vintage pilot uniform, replete with an old-fashioned leather flight helmet, wandering around as if dazed and in the same location that he'd heard the giggling the night before. So this got the director to thinking, and he began to ask other employees about this lone figure. It turned out that this person had been seen for many, many years in the area, and all the stories seemed to be the same. Thinking that this was possibly an actual spirit lurking in the backlot, the director began to research any deaths that might have taken place during filming of movies that had an aviation theme to them. He figured the ghost must have been an actor or an extra who had passed away during filming. Although he didn't find any evidence of a film mishap in the studio archives, he did come across an old Los Angeles Times article dated March 17, 1915, that talked about the opening days of Universal City. The article that the Halloween Horror Nights director found had lines and lines of boring, mundane news bullshit regarding opening weekend. But one section caught his eye, and that was the tale of the sad ending of Frank Stites. It identified the location of his death as being the same area where he and his assistant had heard the giggling, and the same location that all of the other employees claimed to have seen the phantom aviator roaming about. So, could the spirit of the backlot actually be Frank Stites' ghost? The director did a search for Stites to gather more information about the man, and although he did find plenty of stories regarding Stites' life, he realized that after the aviator's death, Frank had simply vanished from the papers. The news cycle marches on, so to speak. Air pioneers who continued to make a name for themselves had completely forgotten about all of his accomplishments and contributions to the advancement of aviation. Could it be Stites wandering the backlot with the hope that he would be remembered? Perhaps he thought that if his ghost were seen, his memory would linger as well. Wondering if the spirit of Frank Stites was hanging out in the backlot of the studio for recognition had given the director an idea. So instead of doing his fucking job and working, he went to the prop department and grabbed a mannequin, went over to the wardrobe, and from the discard section gathered up enough pieces of costume to create a passable version of a 1910-style aviator outfit. Which is something that I would call time clock theft. But what do I know? I have too many tattoos to work at Universal. Fucking assholes. Once his creation was complete, the director took the effigy to the area where the activity was reported and placed it as close as possible to the spot where Frank Stites died. After the mannequin was in position, the director spoke a few words to Stites, letting him know that he would be remembered. Since the effigy has been in place, no more giggling has been heard, and the specter of Frank Stites hasn't been seen since at all. Well, mostly hasn't been seen, I guess. Halloween Horror Nights is now a yearly event, and because of this, many people are involved in making it the premier haunting event in Southern California. And I must say, it is well done. Because of this, it is almost never the same set designers and set grips that work the same area each year. So one year, not realizing what the mannequin's purpose was and thinking it was just a minor backlot set piece, somebody repurposed the tribute as a monster during the studio's Halloween haunt. During that year's event, many guests asked about the actor who was dressed as an old-timey pilot, and many wondered just how the studio had made him look transparent, and how he was able to pass through seemingly solid objects. But being that Universal is one of the greatest movie studios in existence still, most guests just assumed it was a special effects trick and didn't give it much thought. The employees who worked that area, however, knew that there was something odd afoot. Many of the scare actors working in the area of the Psycho House that year began to notice strange shadows passing near them. They would see them out of the corners of their eyes, and when they would look directly at the spot where they thought the figure to be, nothing was there. Others saw shadowy figures and heard giggling, just as the director and his assistant had. Some heard grunts and thuds as if something had fallen over on or near somebody. And still others heard their names faintly called out, as if somebody were luring them. If the scare actors heeded the voice and followed to where it belonged, there would be no one there when they arrived. Many of these actors asked to be relocated within the event, and a few actually quit rather than be placed back in that location. The director, who had originally discovered that the spirit was that of Frank Stites, caught wind of what was happening and decided to go back to the spot where he had placed the mannequin to see what might be causing the new disturbances. He knew right away that the ghost had returned. Somebody had removed the effigy. The director quickly found out where the figure had been moved, located the pilot's uniform, and immediately had the likeness put back where it belonged. Once again, all was quiet on the backlot. It would seem that as long as the effigy of Frank Stites remains near where his body fell that fateful day in March of 1915, his spirit is content in the thought that he is remembered. However, if you take his likeness away, Frank will wander the backlot, perhaps in an attempt to scare the studio into making sure that he is not forgotten. Whatever the case may be, when you are touring around the famous backlot on one of the bright, glamour trams, keep an eye out for Frank and give him a wave if you spot his mannequin. Who knows? It just might be the man himself. No one really knows why a person lingers after death or why he or she stays in a certain place. There are spirits that remain behind in a place where they felt comfortable, and others are seen in various places that they spent time at when they were alive. Lucille Ball is one of these wandering spirits, and one of the places she has been known to appear in is none other than Universal Studios. Lucy is perhaps the most famous comedian who ever lived. Her sitcom, I Love Lucy, which ran from 1951 to 1956, is still in syndication today. One would be hard-pressed to find a person who has not heard of the show. Or, you know, watched as Lucy and her friend Ethel get into all sorts of on-screen trouble. Lucy and Desi became such a big Hollywood power couple that they formed their own studio named Desi Lou and became legends. In a town of legends, in a town of failures. Lucy, for her part, also had a pretty stellar movie career, starting with a string of uncredited roles beginning in 1927 and continuing until the day that she retired. With well over 100 movies and countless television appearances, along with hundreds of episodes from her three TV series, Lucille Ball could be classified as the most prolific actress and comedian in the history of stage or cinema. Maybe this is one of the reasons that Lucille Ball has remained in this realm after death and is seen in so many different places. So the Backlot is kind of an interesting place because it is a fully functioning movie studio. So there's offices down there. There are permanent bungalows, which were kind of used as classier trailers back in the day. And some of them now are rented out as office. Some of them are offices. Some of them are still used as on-set dressing rooms, makeup places, whatever. But Lucy's dressing room is located right across the street from Soundstage 24, where her sitcom Here's Lucy was filmed during its first two seasons, and very near the former attraction, Lucy, a tribute. Some of the reports from her former bungalow include things being moved on their own, like makeup, costumes, and props. Some of them disappeared, only to turn up later somewhere else in the rooms or even in the building next door. There have even been one or two reports of people in the old dressing room seeing a red-haired woman watching them, who will give them a kindly smile before fading from view. And that is truly terrifying. When the redhead watches, be on your guard. Many believe that the woman is Lucille Ball, and that the harmless pranks around the bungalow are Lucy's way of letting everyone know that she's still around and her sense of humor is still intact. Universal Studios is not the only place that Lucy's spirit is seen. In the early days of their career, or their studio's career, Desilu headquarters was in the Hart Building on the lot of Paramount Studios in Hollywood. Once wholly owned by Lucille Ball, it is today one of the oldest buildings on the lot that hasn't been burned down or, you know, retrofitted. Despite all of his cheating and drinking, her husband, fucking Desi Arnaz, the two remained close friends right up until the day that Desi passed away in 1986. The last words that Desi said to Lucy were, "I loved you, honey. Good luck with your show." Lucy had always loved the time that they spent filming, and once said it was the happiest time of her life. This may be the reason that Lucy still hangs around the offices of the old Desilu studio. Reports from those who work in the building say that a woman's ghost haunts the upper floor. They believe that it's Lucy, because the smell of Lucy's favorite perfume almost always precedes any activity. Many of the reports claim that objects are often tossed off of desks onto the floor by unseen hands. Others claim that they have had things removed from their desk drawers or closets and have found them tossed on the floor in other offices down the hall. Quite a few of the reports are made by the male occupants of the building, and it's believed that Lucy, in her own impish way, is flirting with these men. One of the more compelling stories from the Hart Building took place when a security guard was making the rounds on the floor, and he kept hearing the sound of doors opening and closing, so the guard followed the noise as it moved, and when he finally caught up to the sounds, he watched as a door, seemingly of its own accord, slammed shut, reopened, and then slammed shut once again. There was a report of a guard who had actually seen Lucy near her old office. The night watchman, not realizing that it might have been a ghost, approached a woman who was standing in the hallway to inquire about what she was doing in the building. When he was only a few steps away, the woman turned in his direction, smiled at the guard, and simply vanished. The security guard, having grown up watching Lucy on TV, knew immediately who the woman was, and he knew that he had just seen Lucy's spirit. And I'm certain it had nothing to do with working overnight and smoking stimulants. The place that Lucy's spirit is most active is, of course, the house she lived in at the time of her death. On the night of April 17th, 1989, Lucy started experiencing chest pains. Her husband and daughter convinced her to go to the hospital, and she was immediately taken into an operating room, where she underwent 7 hours of open-heart surgery. After she was sent home, she was told that she couldn't climb the stairs to her bedroom and was forced into the guest bedroom. She was unable to care for herself and was being treated as an invalid and had been removed from her bedroom where she had lived with her first husband, Desi Arnaz, with whom she had bought the house originally. The day after Lucy arrived home, her surgically repaired aorta ruptured and she was rushed back to the hospital. Unfortunately, the doctors were unable to save Lucy this time, and she died on the operating table. Lucy's daughter said that her mother no longer thought life was worth living and had decided that it was her time to move on. With the many reports of activity from the owners who had bought the house after her passing, it is unlikely that Lucy actually did move on, though. Gary Morton, Lucy's second husband, sold the house on Roxbury Drive a few years after Lucy had passed. The new owners had the house demolished, although no one really knows why. And then on its site, he had a new home completely built. It would seem that Lucy was not happy with the changes. There is a report of one of Lucy's friends driving past her old home to get a last look at the house. While driving slowly by, the friend glanced up and noticed a woman standing in Lucy's old bedroom. The walls in the front of the house had already been torn down, and the friend had an unobstructed view and was shocked when she realized that it was Lucy that she was seeing. As the passerby stopped her car, Lucy turned toward her, and with a confused and angry look, walked around the corner of the upstairs floor and vanished from view. Once the new house was completed, the reports of activity continued. Many owners who have lived in the home since Lucy's death have claimed that furniture will rearrange while they are away from home. Items will move from one room to another, even while the owners are present. Boxes will be stacked in strange places or moved to different rooms. It would seem that quite a bit of the activity in the home takes place up in the attic. It's not uncommon for ghosts to reside in this part of the house, as many paranormal investigators know, and Lucy has decided that she's comfortable there as well, it seems. Sounds have been heard at all hours of the day and night from the attic and range from the laughter and talking of a loud party to one owner claiming that the I Love You, Lucy theme would play through the vents of the attic throughout the house. Owners have heard the sounds of furniture and boxes stored in the attic moving around on their own, and a woman's laugh at the confusion the noise brought. Even with all the reports coming, they all claim that the activity is never threatening or overly scary. It's mainly just playful and fun. It would seem that Lucille Ball just loves her old home and likes to hang around her old neighborhood. Fuck yeah, piano. One of the most unique sound stages on the Universal lot also is one of the oldest. Soundstage 28 was originally built in 1925 for the filming of The Phantom of the Opera. The reason that I say it was unique has to do with the fact that the entire Paris Opera House interior that we see on the screen was built directly into the stage walls. Over the many years that the soundstage has been in use, this same opera house scene has been used for various movies. Some of the other films shot in this studio include Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Birds, and The Sting. Along with these films, a few of Universal's horror movies were filmed in Stage 28, such as The Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula, Psycho, and the 1943 remake of The Phantom of the Opera, which used the same built-in opera house set as the original film. Because why not? It's already there. Soundstage 28 used to be a part of the backlot tram tour. For those who wanted to get a glimpse into the actual stage, Universal used to conduct VIP tours of the building, which allowed guests to get up close and personal with their famous opera house set and view some of the areas where the stars would get ready for their upcoming movie shoots. Many of those on these tours had heard about the supposed hauntings of the soundstage and would inquire about the stories while listening to the guides. Most wanted to know if it was true that Lon Chaney, a.k.a. the Man of a Thousand Faces, was indeed still hanging around the set of his most famous movie. Lon Chaney was born Leonidas Frank Chaney on April 1st, 1883, to parents who were both born deaf. And I imagine the dating process between the two of them was fucking hilarious. Lon needed to learn sign language to speak with his parents, and that, coupled with having to pantomime as well as during conversations with them, gave Lon an uncanny ability at acting during the silent era of film. It just so happened that Chaney's brother owned a theater, so Lon began acting on stage at an early age, and by 1912 he was trying out for parts on the silver screen. He was usually cast in minor parts as a villain, and his first big break came in 1919, when he was cast as a cripple called the Frog in the film The Miracle Man. Another aspect of Lon Chaney's brilliance that I mentioned earlier at length was his masterful use of makeup, which allowed him to portray any creature, human or monstrous. Lon Chaney truly was a complete actor, and I dare say that no one has come close to his overall expertise. Even though Lon Chaney had been acting for many years before his starring role in The Phantom of the Opera, it was this film that made him a star. His haunting portrayal of Eric, the hideously scarred monster of the film, scared the hell out of audiences and caused them to feel an odd sort of sympathy for the lovelorn creature that they couldn't quite understand. Chaney, for his part, always had a deep appreciation for the way fans responded to his Eric portrayal, and he always thought that the Phantom was one of his best roles. Could this affinity Lon Chaney had for his character and this movie be the reason that he stayed in the soundstage long after his death? Over the years, those working in Stage 28, or as it was known, the Phantom Stage, knew that it was haunted. The security guards who were tasked with patrolling the stage late at night knew this more than most. One of the first reports of activity came from a guard who was working late one night. As he was walking near the back of the stage where the Paris Opera House set was located, he heard a noise above him. When the security guard looked up, he was surprised to see a caped figure staring down at him. When the guard called up to the figure that he needed to come down and get out of the building, the figure darted down the catwalk and vanished from view. The startled guard realized that as the man fled, he made no sound whatsoever. No noise from the wooden walkway. No sound from the metal railing, and no sound of footsteps. The guard looked all around the stage but could find no sign of any intruder. When the guard told his superiors what had happened, they scoffed at him. However, more reports would follow. Besides the continuing reports from the security guards, there have been many other studio employees who have seen the caped figure. Those stagehands who work on the catwalks have seen him many times. On those occasions, when a glimpse of the man's face has been seen, the description is always the same. It is the face of Lon Chaney. One of the strangest reports, and one that has had numerous sightings, is that of Chaney walking about the catwalks and outer areas of the studio carrying a chandelier. I find this report to be especially far-fetched, as the only chandelier that I know of that Lon Chaney would be attached to was the one used during the filming of the Phantom of the Opera movie. The chandelier in question was 40 feet in diameter, and it weighed about 1,600 pounds. It was an exact replica of the one in the Parisian Opera House and was raised and lowered by a heavy chain. So why Cheney would be lugging this thing around is odd. And I can find no reports that it's a different light fixture. So it's my assumption that what people are calling a chandelier is actually a candelabra. As all of the statements regarding these reports are very similar, I believe the tales have been reported with some good old-fashioned California word switch-em-ups, which does happen quite a bit. But Lon Chaney is not the only spirit who occupies the Phantom Stage. Sometime in 1925, during the filming of Phantom of the Opera, an electrician working high up repairing a studio light on the catwalks lost his balance and ate shit and died. That's a bit of a crude way to say that he lost his footing and fell to his untimely demise. Many visitors to the stage have reported seeing a man in old-fashioned clothing walking along the same catwalks as Cheney's spirit. The onlookers claim that the man is just going about his business as if he doesn't know that he is dead and will oftentimes just disappear as they're looking at him. The lights in Soundstage 28 seem to have a mind of their own and will often turn themselves off, sometimes during filming or at other inopportune moments. Then, as quickly and just as mysteriously, will turn themselves back on. Workers and guards who swear that they extinguished the lights when they left the stage for the evening will return in the morning or sometimes even days later to find that every light in the building has been turned back on. Many believe that this is the electrician having a bit of fun with the lighting. But nobody knows. The hit television series The Ghost Whisperer used Soundstage 28 quite often, and strange things would happen while filming. Odd shapes and figures would show up on film in the editing room, even when the crew knew that those figures weren't there during the shoot. Extreme cold spots would inexplicably happen around the actors while they were trying to perform their lines. Sometimes these mysterious patches would be so cold that the actors would not be able to continue until the spot dissipated, and other times it would hit so suddenly that the actor would momentarily forget his or her lines, and the scene would have to be reshot. There were many times when lights would explode for no discernible reason, and other times when the actors would actually see the cloaked and smiling figure of Lon Chaney in their dressing rooms. The crews who worked in the soundstage reported seeing Chaney in the prop room and in the rooms where the costumes were stored. Guests and employees alike have heard the sound of doors opening and closing, and have witnessed doors slamming on their own as they passed by them. In the almost 100 years of service to the studio, Soundstage 28 has seen two world wars, withstood the ravages of numerous earthquakes and destructive fires, and it's weathered them all to stand proud on the backlot of Universal Studios. Unfortunately, as tourism has grown over the years and the demand for more and more attractions to please these fans has increased, the need for more rides and amusement has grown along with it. And Universal Studios, being on a hillside and geographically limited on buildable land, has had to make space where possible. Soundstage's 28 proximity to the theme park's lower lot section was a natural choice to be repurposed for its use in the tourist section of the studio and was slated for demolition. But once word had gotten out about the stage's impending doom, a chorus of voices rose in an effort to have the stage and its opera house set declared a National Historic Landmark. Regrettably, though, neither the building nor the set qualified. Once historic status failed, a group of preservationists started a petition campaign to try to get Universal to reconsider its decision. But, as you might imagine, this also failed. All was not lost, however. Universal Pictures has always been very aware of the fragility of the Hollywood history side of things. It watched over the years as historic set after historic set was lost to a developer's whim. One of the worst cases of destruction came when MGM sold and allowed residential developers to tear down the set for Showboat, Tarzan, and some of the locations used in the filming of Gone with the Wind to erect dumpy McMansions. Universal was not about to make the same mistake. The removal of Soundstage 28 was a difficult decision for the studio as it was built in 1925. The cost to make the stage completely soundproof along with the needed upgrades to keep it competitive with the newer stages on the lot made the investment more than the worth of the building. So Universal began looking for museums and historic preservation groups that could take the opera set and display it to the public. This, too, proved to be an incredibly difficult task. As of this episode, Universal hasn't found anybody willing to take over the care of such an aged set piece, but the studio has yet to give up hope. Universal has carefully removed the Paris Opera House set, at least all of the original set pieces, and carefully warehoused them in a safe and protective environment. It is the hope of many that the studio can find somebody who will show these museum pieces to the public. There's also talk of putting them on display at the theme park so that future generations can see how Hollywood has evolved over the years. Soundstage 28 may be gone, replaced by theme park entertainments and the smell of churros wafting through the air on a crisp summer evening. But what of the spirits who called the stage home? Have Lon Chaney and the Phantom Electrician finally moved on to their final rest? Or have they just moved on to a new place to live within Universal? Well, live, quote. Could they now be entertaining guests in the lower lot of the amusement park area that was adjacent to the stage's location? The lower lot has many reports of paranormal activity, and who knows, maybe Chaney and our jokester electrician are a couple of the spirits now having fun with the guests in this area. So you guys have one more backlot story, and we're still on the movie production area of the park, because you guys wanted Universal Ghost for some fucking reason, and god damn it, Universal Ghost is what you're going to get. I have quite a few fucking alleged ghost stories from Universal. Anyway, one of my favorite stories from the backlot personally is that of Steven Spielberg. It's a Hollywood legend, so to speak, and I'll tell you about it a little bit right now. As a young man, Steven Spielberg used to sneak, they say sneak, but I would call it breaking and entering, onto the Universal Studios backlot and walk around dreaming of a time when he could enter without having to hide. Even though he wasn't supposed to be on studio grounds, nobody ever stopped him, because when they looked at him, clean cut and carrying a briefcase, they figured that he belonged there. Spielberg knew that one day he would be part of Hollywood and Universal, and he never gave up that dream, and one day it came true. And unfortunately, due to his level of fame and notoriety, he's always had to sneak onto the backlot ever since. Steven Spielberg is arguably the greatest director and producer to ever set foot in Hollywood, and his Amblin Entertainment Group is now housed in the old bungalows that once were home to the stars of the past, as I mentioned before, Lucille Ball, but also Abbott and Costello, Tony Curtis, and the master of horror himself, Alfred Hitchcock, one of the greatest directors in history, and whose office Spielberg inherited, along, it seems, with Hitchcock's ghost. Shortly after Spielberg moved into his new offices, he began to notice strange things going on. He would hear noises while sitting at his desk, as if somebody had come up behind him. He would turn around to find an empty room. No matter the time of day or night, he would get the feeling that he was being watched. It was almost as if someone was looking over his shoulder. After a while, Spielberg started to realize that the most common answer to this feeling of not being alone was that his office was haunted. Considering whose bungalow Spielberg was using and the fact that whoever it was liked to look over his shoulder while he worked on his film projects, he had a good idea who that spirit might be. Spielberg began speaking to the spirit, calling it Alfred. He asked the spirit if he would kindly not bother him while working because the feeling the spirit gave him was unnerving. The ghost didn't scare him per se, but it made it hard for him to concentrate on his work. And no matter how many times he asked Hitchcock to leave him alone, the dead director always blew him off. Alfred Hitchcock always had a reputation for being incredibly difficult to work with, and now Spielberg could personally understand the reputation. Over time, it became more and more difficult to get his work done in the office, and Spielberg was finally forced to find a new office. Amblin Entertainment is still housed in the old bungalows that Hitchcock used, but Spielberg's office is now away from the prying eyes of Mr. Hitchcock. So now our haunted tour will take us to the lower lot of Universal. The lower lot area of Universal Studios opened to the public in March of 1991, and it was a much-anticipated addition to the theme park. It was named the Studio Center due to its location near many of the studio's original stages, dressing rooms, and costume warehouses. This area is reached by a quarter-mile-long series of escalators, called the Universal Stairway, which runs from the upper lot down to the new section. And it is by far one of the most amusing rides in the entire park, in my opinion. Some of the attractions in the lower lot at the time included World of Cinemagic, Lucy, a tribute, and added in June of that same year, the E.T. Adventure. Today, this section of the park includes Revenge of the Mummy, an indoor roller coaster which replaced the E.T. Adventure, and Transformers the Ride, a thrilling dark ride. The Jewel of the Lower Lot is one of the most expensive rides ever built, and one that set new standards for ride theming and ride design. Jurassic Park, The Ride, an exhilarating adventure through Steven Spielberg's film, where riders get face-to-face with dinosaurs and get very wet from water. Any other reason is on them. Another aspect of this area of Universal Studios is the large amount of haunting activity reported in this small section of the park. Having spoken with many of the employees working in this section, it is clear that most believe this area is haunted. The Transformers ride is literally next door to where Soundstage 28 was located, which I just told you about and I'm not going to rehash. And Lucille's dressing room is very near. With the movie-making element of the studio directly behind the walls of the rides in this part of the theme park, it shouldn't come as a surprise that spirits might also call this place home. So, the lower lot at Universal has some of the park's most thrilling rides, like I said, Transformers, Jurassic Park, and The Revenge of the Mummy. Jurassic Park is a water ride where guests are menaced by lab-created dinosaurs, and Transformers is a weird, three-dimensional special effects dark ride. Revenge of the Mummy, however, is a thrilling indoor roller coaster through the tomb of a long-dead pharaoh brought back to life as the evil mummy himself. The ride can be scary in and of itself, but when riders catch a glimpse of the ghost that haunts the dark ride, it can become downright terrifying. Reports of this spirit began coming in almost from the day the ride opened. Guests would come off the roller coaster in a state of panic, having witnessed a young boy standing on the tracks as the car barreled down on him at 45 miles an hour. At first, the employees would frantically shut down the ride and rush in, expecting to find an injured or, worse, dead child lying on the platform. Every time the employees arrived at the area where the guests claimed to have seen the boy on the tracks, nothing could ever be found. There was no sign that anybody had been hit or had even been in the area. There also was nothing on the various security cameras set up within the ride. And let me assure you, there are quite a few of them. The reports from the guests continued on and off for a few months following the opening of Revenge of the Mummy, but ride employees and supervisors were starting to see and hear things themselves. All of the reports from the roller coaster were the same. Riders in the front of the roller coaster cars would spot what looked like a boy about 10 years of age wearing early 20th century clothing, standing on the tracks directly in front of their oncoming car. Just as the car was about to hit the child, he would turn, stare at the front seat passengers, and wait as the car seemingly impacted his young body. The reports got to be a daily occurrence, and each and every time the ride operators were told about the young boy, they would shut down the ride to make sure that everything was still okay, even though they began to realize that what the guests were seeing on the roller coasters was most likely a ghost, they still performed their due diligence of checking the ride for safety. The reports began to fade after a few months, and it has been years since the child has been seen within the ride. However, as the reports became less frequent within the Revenge of the Mummy ride, the reports from the Ben & Jerry's Studio Scoop ice cream shop, which is part of the same building, have become more and more common. Could it be that this lost child has decided that ice cream is more to his taste? Nobody knows anything about who this lost little boy is, but the fact that he's always seen in old-fashioned clothing would indicate he was possibly a child actor who died playing a role. A more likely explanation might be that he had been living on and passed away on one of the many ranches that were bought when they were buying up land for the studio. He may not realize he's dead, or perhaps he just enjoys all of the new sights and fun going on at the theme park and decided to hang around. Whatever the case may be, it would be nice to find out who this young man is and possibly help him to move on. Perhaps the most haunted place in the lower lot is the Jurassic Outfitter store directly adjacent to the Jurassic Park ride, and people exiting the ride itself are forced to go through the gift shop and greeted with all sorts of bullshit related to the ride and the blockbuster movies from which it is derived. The riders usually stop to browse the wares, and most are oblivious to the fact that there's a very active spirit in their midst, one who is not shy about letting people know that she is there. If you pick an employee in the Jurassic Outfitter shop at random, goddamn most of them have a ghost story to tell. Many of these tales are similar to other stories that I've told throughout, you know, this episode. Things being moved around in the middle of the night, items falling off of shelves for no discernible reason, and lights that flicker on and off on their own accord. But there are a couple of things here that go far beyond the reports from elsewhere in the park. One thing that's different here at Jurassic Outfitters is that the spirit of a little girl has actually been seen inside the store. One employee told us that she had been working near the end of the day and was looking forward to closing up shop. There were only a few patrons left, and they appeared to be just browsing when she noticed a little girl wandering around in the area where some small toys were sold. The little girl looked between 8 and 10 years old and seemed like she might be lost. The store employee watched the girl for a couple of minutes, and when she realized that there was no adult with the child, she slowly approached her. As the store clerk got near to where the little girl was, the child turned towards her, stared at her, and then simply shook her head and disappeared from sight. The employee said she was shocked at what she had seen, but remembered her co-workers telling her that the store was most likely haunted. And that had just been confirmed for her in the most convincing and terrifying of ways. This type of occurrence with the little girl seems to be very common in Jurassic Outfitters, as I've heard quite a few variations of it while talking to the employees inside the store. There was one other tale told to me that varied from the rest, and it sounded like it could be right out of one of Universal's famous horror movies. A store clerk said that she was working one evening around dusk, and that the crowd was light but constant. She was standing at the register near the exit to the lower lot area and was watching the guests as they browsed various items for sale in the shop. She said that as she turned to look outside the store, a mist began to form right near the entrance. She said that the mist came out of nowhere, and that there was no fog that night, and no special effects going on that would cause it either. As she watched, the mist became so thick that it completely obscured the view of everything beyond the doorway. The clerk went on to say that the mist started to creep into the store, and then the guests began to notice and stare at it as well. The strange fog came into the store about 10 feet, and then it stopped. Now the customers began to back away, some of them commenting that it had to be part of the Jurassic ride, some malfunction of the dry ice fog machine, or something similar. The clerk said that any type of special effect apparatus would be isolated to the inside of the ride structure. Universal prides itself on its safety record and would not have any machinery of this type in proximity to the park guest. The crowd of onlookers was beginning to move towards the exit, having become bored with the wayward fog, and just as they began to step forward, the mist began to dissipate. Just as the fog was about to completely disappear, the clerk heard a sharp giggle, and all of the merchandise near where the mist had been flew off the shelves and landed on the floor among the startled guests' feet. This event took place near the Halloween season, and even though Halloween Horror Nights had not yet begun, the guests began to applaud, as if they had just seen a show. The clerk figured that they assumed it was just another of Universal's famed special effects that they showed the guest and they were gearing up towards the scare season. The employee, however, knew better, and she believed it was a ghost. But who knows? So, as I mentioned, the quarter mile of escalators is by far one of the most amusing rides at the park, at least in my opinion. I love the escalator, but I'm a fucking loser. Okay, so there's one more tale involving the lower lot, and I've heard it from numerous people that I've known that have worked at the parks. It seems to be a fairly rare occurrence, but because I did hear about it, I chose to include it in this episode. And because you asked for Haunted Universal is still what you're getting. So I had a buddy that worked as a security guard at Universal. I'm not going to tell you his name. He doesn't work there anymore, but just for the sake of argument, let's call him Akbar al-Ibn al-Muhammad. So while I was talking to Akbar al-Ibn al-Muhammad, lost my place. Okay, so I was talking to the security guard, my buddy, on a trip to the park, and he mentioned that while patrolling the lower lot well after closing, he noticed that someone was riding on the bottom section of the Universal Stairway, which is the three-tier escalator that connects the lower lot with the upper lot of the amusement park. He told me that he had just come out from the office across the way, and he was surprised that there would be anybody in the area other than another guard. He knew that there were no night film shoots nearby, so this section of the park should have been completely empty, which I'm sure is pretty daunting in its own right. The guard walked over to where he had seen the figure on the escalator, but when he arrived at the spot, he couldn't see that person anymore. He looked around for the individual and then noticed the person was now at the top of the second landing. He could now see that it was a man looking down at him, but could not figure out how the guy had gotten from the bottom of the lower stairway all the way to the top of the second stairway in the amount of time that it had taken him to get over to the lower landing. Even if the man had run at full speed, he shouldn't have been able to make it up that far. When the guard finally reached the second level, the man was nowhere to be found. The guard looked up towards the very top of the Universal Stairway, but didn't see the man. And by this time, he figured the person would be long gone, most likely hightailing it to the park exit to get away. As the employee turned to go back down the two flights of stairs, he looked down and saw that the man he had been following was now at the very bottom, back in the lower lot, and staring at him. Akbar al-Muhammad had no idea how the man had gotten past him. Even if the guy had been crouching down, hiding as the guard had gone past, he should have made some sort of noise going down the escalator. So now, Akbar hurried down the two levels to the bottom, trying to keep an eye on the intruder as he descended. Just as he was beginning to start down the final flight of stairs, the man turned and walked towards the entrance of the Revenge of the Mummy ride. Once the security guard reached the bottom of the escalator, he sprinted over to where he had seen the man walk, but he could find no trace of the intruder. Akbar looked all over the area near the mummy ride, but the man had completely disappeared. So once the guard had given up, he headed back towards the security room. As he glanced in the direction of the Universal Stairway, he once again spotted the man up near the second landing. This time, however, the man was staring at him with a strange little smile on his face. The guard was about to make his way back up the stairway when the man simply shook his head and faded into nothing. Akbar decided that he wasn't about to go chasing what he now realized was a ghost and continued on his way to the guard room. This tale sounds unbelievable, and John, I mean, Ahmed has been known to be a bit of an exaggerator, but numerous buddies of his that worked the security detail at night have reported similar things and very similar experiences. So, either all three of them are real fucking funny, or maybe they did think that they saw somebody crouching on the escalator and teleporting around the lower lot. Or maybe they're all just having fun at my expense. Who knows? Alright, so now our journey continues to the upper lot, which is the upstairs lot of the Universal Park, because as I've mentioned, again, at length, the park is built on a fucking mountain. So, much like my high school, they had to carve into the mountainside and make it in levels. So the upper lot at Universal Studios was formed when Caltrans needed dirt for the construction of the Hollywood Freeway. And for the free dirt, Universal got a flat-topped hill to build a now-famous upper part of the park, which is considered the hub of the theme park. This section of the park is where the Universal City Walk is located, along with the ticket booths, the red carpet, the entryway, some shows, some shops, and the ever-popular Wizarding World of Harry Potter. In essence, the upper lot is, like I said, the heart of the amusement park. The upper lot, or the entertainment center, is where you will find the majority of the theme park rides, theaters, shows, and food establishments, including Despicable Me, The Simpsons Ride, and many children's rides and attractions in Super Silly Funland, which I don't think I've ever been to, along with the exceedingly popular Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey experience, which takes riders through a Quidditch-infused adventure in and around Hogwarts with Harry, Hermione, and Ron as companions. The upper lot is also where you will find hit shows, such as the special effects show Waterworld, and, allegedly, the new Walking Dead maze that takes guests through a zombie-infested world of horror, but I've never seen it. There are also plenty of food choices here with the Three Broomsticks, fast becoming the park favorite, as well as Luigi's Pizza, Gru's Cafe, and even Lard Lad Donuts for those who want to munch on the run. Hamburgers and hot dog stands are an easy find as well. There's an endless supply of things to do here in the entertainment center. Perhaps this is why the area also has its fair share of spirits wandering its themed streets and enjoying its thrilling rides. I did find a fair amount of boring-ass fucking stories from the upper lot, but I just picked my favorite because you can only listen to, and then the product moved around to another room. You can only hear that so much before you just tune me out. And this is already a long fucking episode, so I'm picking my favorite. Okay? And if you guys want more Universal Ghosts, tough titties, because this is going to be it. All right, anyway. Tragedy can strike anywhere and at any time, even in a happy place like Universal Studios. When a person is struck with severe depression or some other mental illness, that tragedy can manifest as self-destructive behavior and the need to eliminate that which is perceived to be the cause of that depression. This is exactly what happened on April 3rd, 2015. On that fateful day in April, a young man, distraught over losing his girlfriend, went to the theme park to confront his former partner about their breakup. The couple had a child together, and the split had hit the man hard. The woman, who was an employee at one of Universal Studios' restaurants, had already taken out several restraining orders on her estranged boyfriend. But that was not going to stop him from seeing her. On this day, however, he had decided that one way or another he was going to put an end to the situation and arrived at the theme park determined to see it done. As the young man nervously paced the area next to his estranged partner's workplace trying to figure out his next move, his ex noticed him from a window and immediately called park security. Because the restaurant was located next to the children's area of the park, security wasn't fucking around with the safety of its guests, and they immediately called the ever-trigger-happy Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. When the officers arrived, they were immediately escorted to the young man's location, but the sight of the police, as you might imagine, it agitated him. And no matter how hard the officers tried, they could not calm him down. Unfortunately, the man was in no mental shape to cooperate, and as the officers came near, he quickly pulled out a pistol, placed it to his head, and blew his fucking brains out. He died instantly from the gunshot, but this is not the end of the man's story, however. Since that day, strange things have been happening near the area where the young man blew his brains all over this iconic Hollywood landmark, which is unfortunate. Some of the employees that I've talked to over the years told me that a spirit is seen leaning up against the rail of the overlook. They can tell that it's a young man, but he seems to be completely oblivious to everything going on around him. He just stares out over the cliff face, looking down at the lower lot or off into the distance in the direction of the nearby mountains. These employees have stated that many of them have tried to approach the man, but every time somebody gets too close, the spirit just disappears. The overlook where the man committed suicide is directly adjacent to the area of the park designated for young people. The Super Silly Funland is close to the viewing area, separated only by a water play zone that allows children to get exceedingly wet. Because of this, Universal has installed a locker room where parents and guardians can keep towels, a change of clothes, and any other item they might need to make sure their kids are comfortable after a prolonged soaking. This area, including the locker room and bathroom, have had reports of this young man wandering around as if in a daze. He never approaches anyone, but will gaze at the kids in an almost fatherly way. People who know the story wonder if he is thinking about his child, and how he will never be a part of the young one's life again. Again, if he is approached in this area, he will simply vanish from view. The entrance to the Super Silly Funland is another spot where this lost soul is seen. Here the man is simply found walking into the children's amusement zone. The odd thing about this occurrence is the fact that he is seen moving only a short distance into the area before disappearing and reappearing outside the kids section, where he once again walks in, once more vanishing from view. No one can remember him going into this section before he took his own life, so why he would continue to do this after death is a bit of an ongoing mystery. There is one other place this man has reportedly been seen, but the employee who mentioned this could not verify that the story he heard was true, or just a tale told by a coworker to try and scare him, which it seems that there's a fair amount of this that goes on at Universal based on what I've heard from the people that I've known personally who are employees. But what I was told was that this young man is occasionally seen sitting at one of the tables at Gru's Cafe. The employee said that the entity is never seen at the same table and is never there at any particular time. The employee was told that when the man does show up in the eatery, he is seen in solid form and not as a ghost or spirit. He was told that if anybody approaches the table where he is sitting, he will simply disappear and not return for days or weeks. So one thing seems clear about this spirit. He seems unsure of what is happening around him or to him. This seems to be a common case with suicide. The young man has never been frightening or aggressive towards any guest or employee, and it seems clear that he is just lost and possibly looking for answers. But on a personal note, fuck this guy, because now they have metal detectors at the park on the way in. He can eat my ass. Thank you. Okay, so this is another story from the upper lot, and it was told to my buddy by two employees who could not seem to agree on any of the details. And one of those details would be where it happened. One clerk said that it occurred in the feature presentation shop, directly across from the studio store, while the other employee swore that it happened in Production Central. The story is an interesting one, or at least I thought it was an interesting one, and because I'm not really sure where it took place, I'm just going to assume it happened inside of the store where the two employees were working when they told my buddy about it. So that would be Production Central. Production Central is just a generic Hollywood tourist trap store where they sell refrigerator magnets, Fast and the Furious shit, fake whatever those awards are that they give actors. I don't know. Academy Awards? Golden Globes? I don't fucking know. I hate all that shit. But according to the two people that were working in the store, just after noon, there was a crowd in the store and it was beginning to pick up. They were taking turns helping guests who had questions, and they were manning the cash register for those with purchases when one of them noticed that the mannequin in the store had been moved. It was supposed to be facing the front of the shop, but now turned away from the entrance and it was facing the back wall. The clerk said that when he had gotten a moment, he went and moved the mannequin back into position and then resumed helping the guests. The other employee had noticed her co-worker moving the figurine and had just assumed that an unruly guest had moved it, thinking that it would be funny. My friends and I used to do that all the time when we were teenagers. We would move mannequins everywhere in the mall. It was hilarious, but I'm sure not for the employees. Only about 10 minutes after the clerk rearranged the mannequin, he glanced back over at it and found that it had once again been moved to face the back of the store. This time, the employee looked around the shop to see if he noticed anybody who looked familiar. He thought somebody might be playing tricks on him and hiding in the store somewhere and then moving the figure when he and his coworker weren't looking. But he didn't see anybody who looked familiar or anybody who looked guilty hiding outside. So he went back inside, moved the mannequin once again, and then told his coworker to keep an eye on the dummy. If someone was trying to play a prank on them, they would catch him. Once the early afternoon crowd had thinned out and the two clerks could take a breather, they were talking behind the cash register when one of them saw that the mannequin was once again facing the wrong way. Both of them swore to each other that they had been keeping a close eye on the figurine for the last hour or so, and they hadn't seen anybody messing with it. How, then, had it completely turned in the opposite direction from the way it should be facing? The clerk who had been placing the dummy back to its proper position once more went and moved it. This time, when he turned to walk back towards the register, he heard his co-worker let out a gasp. When he asked her what had happened, she pointed to the mannequin that he had just moved. And when the young man looked at the figurine, it was facing the back wall of the store yet again. The employee hadn't heard a thing, but his coworker told him that she had just seen it turn all on its own. The employee thought his coworker was having fun with him and scoffed at her. When, out of the corner of his eye, he saw that the mannequin was moving. Both he and the other clerk turned to watch the figure rotating back to where it was supposed to be facing. They looked at each other, and both ran for the exit of the store. Once outside in the bright sunlight of the day, they realized that they had left the shop completely unmanned. Neither wanted to go back into the store, but they had no choice in the matter. They couldn't very well leave the shop with no one to look out for it, and no one to attend to the guests who were going to come and look for souvenirs. Reluctantly, both of the dedicated employees re-entered the shop and resumed their duties. I was told that once the clerks went back in, both of them looked at the mannequin and asked that it not move for the rest of their shift, and asked that it please not scare them or their customers. And they were both relieved when the figure stayed put. And since that day, neither of them has ever seen the mannequin move at all. Those same two employees also told my buddy, who related to me, about a story that they heard that came from a friend of theirs who worked in feature presentation near the park entrance. This store stocks a large amount of Harry Potter merchandise, including chocolate frogs. It seems that there is a spirit in this shop that likes to knock the frogs off of the shelves and then make the boxes jump around on the floor. After my buddy heard this tale, he walked down to the feature presentation to speak with the employees there, but none of them would admit to the story. However, it should be noted that one of the managers said that the reason the chocolate frogs keep falling off the shelves was because they were chocolate, and therefore the candy would expand and shrink depending on the temperature, which caused them to fall to the floor. However, it is worth noting that they sell chocolate frogs all over the park, and they only seem to do this in this one particular store. And finally, dear listeners, that is it. As the shadows lengthen and the echoes of our tales fade into the night, we draw the curtain on yet another journey through the twisted corridors of the Anthology of Horror podcast. I am Springheel Jack, your sentinel at the crossroads of dread and delight, thanking you for your courage and your company. In tonight's foray into the heart of darkness at Universal Studios, we peeled back the veneer of glamour to reveal the phantoms that dance just out of the limelight. Remember, dear listeners, that the stories we've shared are but whispers from the abyss. There are always more secrets lurking, waiting for their moment to step into the light. If tonight's tale has stirred the embers of your curiosity or sent a shiver down your spine, consider this an invitation to join us again. Follow us into the shadows, where horror and history intertwine, at DukeLandis17 on Instagram.com. It's here that you'll find spooky behind-the-scenes shit, and you'll also be able to vote. When the fancy strikes me, you'll be able to vote on the next episode's content. Please also make sure to check out the other shows on the network. Foxhound43 on Rumble is a great game streamer and all-around hilarious guy. And make sure to check out Scary Jerry's shows. He has Demented Darkness as well as Dark Side of the Nerd. He's a great guy. His shows are a ton of fun. And please go over there and check him out. It'll be worth the time. I'm fucking mumbling because I'm tired and in a bad mood. But make sure to check out the other shows on the network. Make sure to check out the merch store at aohpmerch.com. Please, and once again, if you want to participate in Instagram polls for the next episode, you can do so by following me at DukeLandis17. So, until we meet again, keep a light on and keep your wits about you. The line between reality and the realm of horror is thinner than you think, and who knows what tomorrow's darkness might bring. Farewell from the Anthology of Horror podcast. May your dreams be filled with eerie tales and haunted whispers. Good night. And stay spooky. 20s, 50s, 100s, 100 grand. 20s, 50s, 100s, 100 grand. 20s, 50s, 100s, 100 grand. Up to the club, walked in slowly. Flash for a sec, saw this model that know me. She was looking, and I was looking, and we was looking. Together we like 100 grand. All so mature, all in the mix. Bartender set it up, hit me with a fix. Pose for the flicks, froze on my wrist. Shorty in my ear like, can I get a kiss? Grabbing on my hand, licking on her lips. High gloss finish, working them hips. Backing that thing up, turning me on. Drop it to the ground, show me that thong. Put it in your life, make it smile in the morn. Exchange the math, hit me on the horn. Spend a couple dollars, baby girl, I'm on. Don't make me wait too late, I'm she gone. She got a face like a model, body like a stripper. Do what she got just to get with her. She works it, 25, 50, 75, 100, so fly. She looking like a honey. She got a face like a model, body like a stripper. Do what she got just to get with her. She works it, 25, 50, 75, 100, so fly. She looking like a honey green. Shorty at the bar, spending that cash. Not too much worry, cause she makes that bag. Manola won the hill. Body like that, friends with one name, Dior's intact. Me and you, what a perfect match. I love the way you move, work that back. She did it like, she got it like,
Now she moving like she feeling just like a 100 grand. My attention dripping wet. Take you to my crib, but I don't know yet. A couple more drinks, you might see a sunrise view from a president's suite. Trip over in Vegas, Niagara Falls. Overlook the view, you scratch the